This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
I am sorry. It seems she's hurting you. I meant well.
People always mean well. They cluck their thick tongues and shake their heads and suggest oh so very delicately. Of course, I've suggested it myself, but I hate to even think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac, a raving thing. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Popcorn Culture. I'm Sharmila Ganesan. And over Zoom, we have, as always, Arvind Yuvraj. And joining us in place of our dear Lee Chui Lin, Cam Ruslan. Thank you for filling in big shoes, but we're very glad to have you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And today, we're kind of turning the camera a little bit towards filmmakers, or rather filmmakers that we think have been influential in filmmaking, Hollywood, pop culture, culture in general, because really, as that little clip probably just showed us, films need someone to helm the show.
I recognize that clip. That was yes. Psycho.
Yes,
I got that one.
Cam, I wanted to ask you, like, is this the third time you're doing this with us? Is this like the trilogy, the a bit of popcorn culture trilogy that has come to an end? Is this the third part in that saga?
Is this the Return of the King? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but then yes. if it's The Hobbit, then you can come back for another three.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's how Hollywood works these days.
Yes, please.
Yes, that's how Hollywood works.
Yeah.
So basically, like, just talking about, like you said, the filmmakers who have shaped the better part of Hollywood and the filmmakers in them. So, you know, your Hitchcocks, as you just heard, like your Kurosawas, your Goddards, your Spielbergs, your Kubricks. Basically, anyone who has had such a big impact that other filmmakers either try to replicate them or replicate them successfully. Mm. And we're going to cover those kinds of filmmakers.
So I thought it would be nice to maybe start from an audience perspective, because I do think that influential filmmakers, when it comes to other filmmakers, can be quite different from influential filmmakers when it comes to the audience. So I thought it would be kind of interesting to first define what that even means. And I was wondering, Cam, as both a filmmaker and a member of the audience, who would you say are some of the people that come to mind when you hear the phrase influential filmmaker?
Well, there's standing on the shoulders of giants. Mm. And a lot of the times, especially in modern cinema, even the filmmakers themselves now are not necessarily consciously aware of the predecessors. I mean, you know, D.W. Griffiths, Buster Keaton, etc. I mean, if you look carefully, you will see, but it may not be a conscious decision. So for the new crop of filmmakers who might be in their 30s now, they're not necessarily thinking about Kurosawa. Mm. But they might be thinking more, I think, in recent times, someone like Quentin Tarantino.
Yes.
It's hugely influential.
Who himself, though, is inspired by those who came
Absolutely,
before him.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing about film, isn't it? It's sort of like bit by bit, block by block, the DNA of so many of the filmmakers who came before end up, like you said, even without them realizing it, they're sort of carrying that tradition forward.
Do you think, like, filmmakers have the responsibility to go back and watch films from the older guys? Like you said, you know, filmmakers in their 30s might not be thinking about Kurosawa. They might not even be thinking about Hitchcock. But do you think to make proper films, they have to go back and watch those films? Like, they have to watch the Orson Welles, they have to visit cinema history. Or is it better for them to sort of pave their own way and find their own style instead of falling back on these giants who have, like, sort of carved Hollywood out?
Well, you mentioned Orson Welles. He famously, when he made Citizen Kane, he admitted that he really knew nothing about filmmaking or films.
Oh, yeah.
And he had one of his assistants make cards saying, this is a close-up, this is a wide shot, this is a dissolve. And so he was coming from knowing nothing, it seems. But I do believe, Yes, I do believe that you have to. But that's why I hate somebody like Guy Ritchie. I kind of buy Guy Ritchie because he...
You don't think he's an influential filmmaker today?
Sadly, he might be influential. Yeah. But I think he says out loud, like, he knows nothing about films, doesn't care, he just turns up and he makes things. And I feel like when I'm watching those films, I need to hold on to something. It's like, oh, that's like that. This comes from that tradition. We're moving in that direction.
But isn't that exactly like what Orson Welles did? Like, you just mentioned that he didn't know how to make films. Like, he just he followed cue cards and he got people to teach him. Isn't Guy Ritchie doing the same thing in a way?
I feel like that sentence got sacrilegious fast.
You're lucky you're over there on Zoom, very far
virtually,
away.
Yep.
I'll find you though.
I'm sure you will.
But it's a fair question. Why is Orson Welles allowed to do it,
Because he was a genius, and he came from theatre, and he'd studied the art of theatre. So he was taking theatrical forms and putting them in film. He knew how to make actors better. The beautiful thing about Orson Welles movies, people, if you go back and watch them, is overlapping dialogue. It was a whole new art form for cinema. So he still brought something very new because he came from a different tradition and he knew that craft.
Mm. So if, for us personally then, who would you name, Cam, if you had to call someone in your sort of sphere of cinema, films that you enjoy, a filmmaker that truly shaped that kind of cinema?
I would say someone like, say, David Lean. Mm. David Lean, who made Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, big epic movies. He was an editor at first, so he really knew how to cut the thing together, how to pace it beautifully. A very important influence on the likes of Steven Spielberg, who himself, he says he likes to watch that movie at least once a year, if not before he's going off to make a new movie. But we're talking about an older generation who were influenced by him. Perhaps Spielberg is then able to move the influence onto a new generation. But I think that you don't see the David Lean style anymore. It's a completely different... cinema is just very different.
And that's something I do want to pick up on, the idea of a waning influence a little bit later. Mm. But Arvind, what about you? I mean, when you think of influential filmmakers.
Oh, Michael Bay. For sure.
Arvind, God.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you, Arvind.
No, but... Yeah.
Sorry, we've said Guy Ritchie and Michael Bay in the first quarter of a show on great filmmaking.
Within like 3 minutes,
yes.
Yeah. No, but I know we joke, but Michael Bay is a very influential filmmaker. He's not my favorite, obviously. I'm not going to pick Michael Bay, but the kind of tech that he has created, the way he shoots films, the angles, I mean... What would action films be without Michael Bay? And he's come off as a bit of a joke because of, you know, he makes mega blockbusters that have no substance. And most of his films are trash. But, you know, the kind of impact he had on Hollywood, I think, is going to be felt like for decades, especially since he invented new tech to shoot films. But for me, it would have to be Spielberg. It's very recent, but Spielberg has to be it. He hasn't made a lot of good films recently, but the stuff that he made early on, especially in the early 90s, late 80s, I think that has had like a huge impact on the way that I personally watch movies.
Mm-hmm. We do need to cut to break soon, but I wanted to say that for me, the first person that actually came to mind, and I surprised myself, was Charlie Chaplin. And I think that's because I grew up watching so many of these films, and I never realized that he was both the creator as well as the performer until I was much older. And I realized that a lot of Chaplin's films, the physicality, the framing, the comedy, are still present in films that we watch today, even if it's not necessarily comedy. But if you look at something like even Wes Anderson, the way people move within the frame, the blocking of the background versus the object versus the actors, I feel like he's one filmmaker that continues to be relevant, perhaps because of the physicality of his work. But we do need to take a quick break. But we want to hear from you. Who are the directors that you think are the most memorable, who have influenced Hollywood filmmaking, pop culture? So we're asking you that on Twitter. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. The Twitter handle, of course, is at BFM Radio. You can also call us if you'd like to. We'll be back after a short break. This is Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 7:47 and you are listening to Popcorn Culture with me, Sharmila, Arvind and Cam Ruslan. And we are back in 2001, forward in the time it was supposed to be in the future.
A radio odyssey.
Yes, but Kubrick world. And I think that's a sort of great jumping off point to the conversation that we've been having about the idea of influential filmmakers. And I think along with Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick is one of those names that, you know, every film school graduate, every movie snob or nerd is sort of has them hammered into their heads as the definitive filmmakers of the last 100 years. But I think, you know, I think it's quite telling that we mentioned Michael Bay or Guy Ritchie, because I think the interesting conversation there is, what exactly does influential mean? Do we only talk about high cinema, art, artistic vision, or are we also talking about box office numbers?
Well, box office, I think, is everything, and it's really taking over. It just so happens I've been watching a lot of revisiting Kubrick, and I do feel like I'm watching museum pieces. I love Kubrick, but in terms of influences, I don't know if you see that anymore. Kubrick was also a man who created his own path. He fought against the whole movie system. He made sure he could only make movies that were like a 45-minute drive from his own home. I don't think you see it anymore. Also, when I was watching Kubrick, I'm not saying the man was a misogynist, but his female characters are either few and far between or really kind of nothing. And in terms of influences, you just can't do that now.
No, I agree. I do think that many filmmakers kind of fall out of favor is strong in terms of someone like Stanley Kubrick. Certainly in someone like Woody Allen, he's definitely fallen out of favor. And then I wonder whether that influence stands true. I love Stanley Kubrick and I am a woman. And yes, I find some of those films disturbing. But I also feel like they're sort of time capsules.
I mean, if the stories that came on from The Shining, the set of The Shining, those itself should tell you the kind of filmmaker that Stanley Kubrick is. They're like, they are their own horror stories within a horror story, the way he wanted to get the emotions out from the actors and stuff. So it is, I mean, it's questionable. I don't know if those things would fly today because we have social media and we have a peek into their lives. But back then it was, I think you could pluck like any influential filmmaker and find something questionable about the way they did things. I'm not blanket statement, but I'm saying that chances are you'd find something that you wouldn't like.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, someone more current, perhaps, we do have a listener on the line. Hi, Sanjay. Are you? Can you hear us?
Hey, guys. Yeah, I can hear you loud and clear.
So I hear you are a Tim Burton fan.
I am, actually. I think when you guys talk about influential directors, I think one of the things that actually stood out and kind of jumped to the top of my mind was the... there are a lot of elements in direction. I mean, of course, you've got your cinematography and your Guy Ritchie camera angles. But one of the things that I think really stood out for me was art direction. And I think that Tim Burton actually had a very unique art direction that he's carried through a couple of decades now, ever since, when the earliest I can remember of your Edward Scissorhands and your Beetlejuice, those type of movies all through to Batman. And he's still going strong with some recent ones, your Sweeney Todd's and I think your Alice in Wonderland. So I think art direction has been, I think if you break down the couple of elements of film and direction and filmmakers, I think when it comes specifically to art direction, I think a huge influence has been Tim Burton. And I think it's also kind of been a little bit of, when it came to Tim Burton, also another cross, just to jump to another one, would be that dark humor that sometimes some of his movie has. Mm-hmm. And then that darkness kind of, I feel, also for me, jumps out, which is your Christopher Nolan movies. And then he's kind of brought that darkness then to your superhero and your more commercial classic. So yeah, those two would kind of stand out for me. But Tim Burton mainly, just because of the timeline and the classic works he's done.
Thank you so much, Sanjay. I'm a huge Tim Burton fan as well.
Yeah.
Early Tim Burton more than later.
Early Tim Burton.
Sweeney Todd, I think, was kind of the last one he did that I truly enjoyed. But quite interestingly, speaking of art direction and just sort of a very distinctive visual look, someone WhatsApped in about Wes Anderson, and they said Wes Anderson is an author. His films are so memorable. They tell the story. And three of his films, The Royal Tenenbaums, Moonrise Kingdom, and The Grand Budapest Hotel, really are wonderful. Those are also my three Wes Anderson films.
I love Wes Anderson. Wes Anderson. I just clarify one thing. You're talking about art direction. Actually, what you're really talking about is production design. The grand design. Art direction is the fellow who decides how many books shall I put in this bookshelf. Yes, I think that there is a movement toward making movies where art direction is a really important feature, and I think that Tim Burton would be the poster boy for that. But having said that, Tim Burton doesn't know how to end a movie. He doesn't know how to pace a movie. He doesn't know how to make a movie.
Yeah. Oh, no. Okay. See?
Well, no, for him, it's like, it's a beautiful picture and I'm going to put my wife in it.
Or Johnny Depp. Or both of them.
Yeah, Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp has ruined his career.
So I'm seeing all of these
on
things
the iceberg
as good,
of Tim Burton.
Things. Just to be clear, Sanjay, Cam and I are on opposite ends of this.
I think if you took like Tim Burton and like production design, like you said, I think you could draw a line directly to someone like movies like Metropolis and someone like Fritz Lang.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? Because if, I mean, cinema, like production design became a big thing back then with Metropolis, you know, like how you could design sets and they both have a lot of noir work going on. I think they both love to play with lighting and shadows. And Tim Burton loves the gothic stuff. I think Fritz Lang is the one who pioneered that look, the steampunkishness of things. So yeah, definitely. I if you followed the breadcrumbs, you would go back to Fritz Lang, I think. I'm not sure. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure he watched a bunch of his movies and tried to replicate it. And he did it successfully. I think he's one of the few ones to do it very, very successfully.
So that actually brings us back to that question of what makes a director good or bad? Like, is it dollars and cents? And Tim Burton has many fans. Tim Burton has made many films that have done very well versus perhaps someone that you might think of as a quality filmmaker but doesn't really make it in the cinema. So at the end of the day, is someone influential if so few people saw the work?
Well, by definition, no, I suppose. And I mean, I'm sure his or her mother loves them, but no, you've got to influence people in order to be influential. Mm. But sometimes, you know, the influence can come years later.
Yes.
Arvin mentioned Metropolis, which kind of disappeared at its time, and also the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari also kind of disappeared in their own time, 1919. And years later, they're rediscovered in the 60s, say, and then it becomes an explosion of influence. You mentioned Charlie Chaplin. He's on a hiatus. Buster Keaton disappeared for years and then came back. Mm. And it very much influenced Jackie Chan.
And the idea of influence also, and you make that point, Cam, that I don't think people realize in their time that they are influencing someone. I mean, you need to kind of see a generation of people take root after you and see that strain being carried on.
Yeah, but who owns the influence, though? Like, if, let's say, someone like someone comes up with a style, let's say, but they're an indie filmmaker, like avant-garde filmmaker, 10 people watch their films in like a small cinema, no one knows who they are. And then someone else like a Wes Anderson, I'm not saying Wes Anderson stole his style, I'm just saying if a Wes Anderson watches it and sort of replicates that, who owns that style in the future? Like, who can say they're the influencers? And there are a lot of indie filmmakers doing that, like coming up with ways of shooting film that is sort of taken by the commercial guys.
Mm. I think at the end of the day, the guy who reaches the people, I mean, Cam's words, right? The idea of influence is that you have to influence people.
But also it comes from strange directions. I think that new filmmakers and indeed audiences, whoever it is who's designing computer games, is influencing people, is influencing the way the film is made and it's received, and, you know, the POV shots and the tracking movements and things, which someone like me, who doesn't play video games, might be lost on me. But I can tell that, we're using the language of computer games and the production design and art direction of computer games in movies.
So just to sort of close off this section, because we played Stanley Kubrick, we have a message in from someone who says, well, thank you for today's topic about influential directors. Kubrick certainly has given many influences to films from sci-fi, thriller, horror. 2001, when it came out, wasn't really understood. But then Christopher Nolan referenced his work for Interstellar, for the stellar Interstellar, he says, pun intended. Horror-wise, The Shining continues to influence horror films from the early 80s onwards. And special shout out to my favorite director, Wong Kar-wai. No one has come close to art house noir like Wong Kar-wai, giving us isolated characters, longing for the desired. Fallen Angels and Chungking Express are this listener's favorite. And he says his influence was so profound that even Sofia Coppola thanked him in her Academy Awards speech. So do keep your thoughts coming. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Or you can call us at 773-2900. Tell us who the directors you think have done the most to influence Hollywood and pop culture today. We'll be right back. This is Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
Home.
You're right. That's E.T.'s home.
E.T. Home phone.
E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home. E.T. phone home. He wants to call somebody.
Home.
E.T. phone home.
E.T. phone home.
It is 8:07 in the evening, and you're listening to Popcorn Culture with Sharmila, Cam, and Arvin. And that was the movie that made a generation of children want a little alien that they could hide in their bedroom.
I've never seen it.
You've never seen E.T.?
I have never seen E.T.
E.T.?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
okay, right. Well, that was by Steven Spielberg, incidentally. a little indie filmmaker that we've actually had a bunch of really nice messages coming in, so I thought I'd get to some of them first. So over on Twitter, Shamil Razak, because we've been asking you to tell us who your favorite, most memorable filmmakers are when it comes to this idea of being influential. On Twitter, Shamil says, Hayao Miyazaki. So yes, extremely influential for a particular kind of animated cinema from Japan. I love Miyazaki as well. And then we have on WhatsApp, Yo Leng Sui says, Sofia Coppola, Lost in Translation, made a generation. The only female name we've had come up so far, I think. We have Zikri, who says one of the most influential film directors are James Wan and Lee Whannell, the directors of the first Saw movie. They influenced all of the last generation horror movies, from torture horror movies to the Conjuring universe. And our very own Dashran texted in to say, I'm going to put Hitchcock, Kurosawa, and etc. aside and pick Maniratnam, who is easily one of, if not the most influential filmmakers in Indian cinema. Not many Indian filmmakers had a distinct cinematic language in the 80s, and few of them have one now, but Maniratnam changed the game. He hasn't made a great film in a while, but many young Indian filmmakers draw inspiration from his films and have cited his films as the reason they fell in love with cinema. Absolutely gorgeous films that cut deep into your soul. So I think all of these filmmakers, and like people like James Wan and Spielberg, who we spoke about earlier, I think they bring up this interesting question of people often feel a little embarrassed, I think, to mention people like Spielberg on the same breath as people like Kubrick or Hitchcock. But as we can see, for many audience members, a director like Steven Spielberg was hugely influential.
I think that there certainly was a time. Let's say E.T., you could mention him in the way that Arvin mentioned Michael Bay just now. So a little bit ironically, but at the same time, you know, box office understanding.
I'm going to interrupt you because someone has said, Cam, goodness, that is a travesty. Go see E.T. now.
I know I should, but I don't know. I mean, it's like I know I'm going to be bawling my eyes out, and it's like, you know, it's just too much. But I'd say that Spielberg knew what he was doing, and he made Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And after going through that movie, then he goes into like the canon of greats, and he can be spoken of as, you know, a great filmmaker.
I
It's a great film. It is a great film.
Oh, I love Schindler's List, but go, Aaron. Yeah.
No, I don't know. I mean, you can't argue that Spielberg is the father of the modern blockbuster. I don't know what summer movie season would be without Jaws. Like, he basically showed you that you could take this huge commercial thing and make it good, like a quality film, win awards with it, and also make, like, proper cinema, you know? So I don't know.
What if Michael Bay went on and made Schindler's List?
I would give Michael Bay all the credit in the world. If he could make a Schindler's List, I would be like, hats off to you for making a movie like that. And I think that's what Spielberg sort of proved, because he makes movies like The Post. He makes basically all his Tom Hanks projects are his prestige projects. But then he also goes on the side to make these massive, massive blockbusters that go on to make like billions of dollars. So I don't know. I think Spielberg is really in a league of his own. I know that's not popular to say, but I think he controls a bracket that not many other filmmakers are in.
No, I think I'm with Arvind on this one. I think the idea of influence or shaping an idea of what film is important, and Spielberg certainly did that for a whole generation of people, a few generations of people, in fact. And the idea of event cinema, the idea of watching something in that scale, telling a story in that scale, he pretty much pioneered that.
Oh, I love Spielberg. I think he's a fantastic filmmaker. But in a way, with that event cinema, he simultaneously created an entire box office universe and destroyed another one. Because before he came along, The Godfather and Godfather Part II were the most successful movies. You can watch those now and it's like reading a really wonderful novel. Whereas you go watch Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is a great, fun film, but it's not even middle brow. it's fun, and so fun has become a thing that we aspire to achieve.
But I think there's a difference between a Spielberg and a Michael Bay, in that Spielberg has craft, has storytelling technique, and he knows how to, for lack of a better word, I think to have heart in his cinema.
Absolutely. Yeah. There are families and broken homes in the middle of every single one of his films. And they are so moving for that. E.T., that's one of the reasons I'm too scared to watch E.T. because I know that it's going to touch the child scared core in me.
I mean, the chemistry between kids and the chemistry between people is another thing. J.J. Abrams tries to replicate Spielberg with all of his films.
A huge influence for J.J. Abrams, yeah?
Yeah. Like massive influence. Stuff like Super 8 is basically a throwback project, you know, paying tribute to Steven Spielberg. So that's another thing, like getting characters to talk to each other in a way that feels and sounds like they actually know each other, as opposed to them just reading off a script.
And I think on that, on that vein of directors who are closer to maybe modern times, people who are still around, who have shaped an entire mode of filmmaking, you mentioned Francis Ford Coppola, but his disciple in many ways is Martin Scorsese. Almost contemporaries, but, wouldn't have been a Goodfellas without a Godfather in that sense. And he too makes films that are hugely successful. They're not necessarily art house cinema aspiring.
He does like a bit of box office. Mm-hmm. he has an eye for that. I mean, a lot of gangster movies, people like gangsters. So come see my movie. But he's getting on, and I feel his age now. The Irishman, for instance, spending so much money and trying to make old people look young. Just hire young actors. Find the new De Niro, for God's sakes. Spielberg's really maturing well. The Bridge of Spies, I thought, which is a fairly recent movie, I really liked that. Yeah. The pacing and everything, it's so refreshing.
So you're saying like these filmmakers have like cliches, or they've sort of built a gimmick for themselves that they keep falling back into. Like Tarantino has his own gimmicks that he keeps falling back into. It's a breed of violence that he likes to bring to the screen. Spielberg has his own breed of the chemistry that we spoke about. And Scorsese has like the gangster the gangsters that he can't get out of.
So we do need to break, but I'm so glad you ended on that note, Arvind, because we're going to play out this part of the show with a clip from Goodfellas.
As far back as I could remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged. And to me, it meant being somebody in a neighborhood that was full of nobodies. They weren't like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a hydrant and nobody ever gave them a ticket. In the summer, when they played cards all night, nobody ever called the cops.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
I'm here for Mr. Wallace. I'm Love.
He named you. Must be special.
I'm here for Mr. Wallace. Follow me.
The ancient models give the entire endeavor a bad name. What a gift, don't you think? From Mr. Wallace to the world. The outer colonies would never have flourished had he not bought Tyrell, revivified the technology, to say the least of what we do.
Welcome back to Popcorn Culture. I'm Sharmila, and with me, Arvind and Cam. So we are talking today about influential filmmakers, the people who have shaped movies as we know it, the ones who whose legacy, I suppose, lives on, continue to live on in the films that we watch. And we've actually been getting a fair number of very interesting thoughts from you, so keep them coming. You can continue to tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or give us a call at 7733-2900. Arvind, I wanted to pick up on where we left off before we went for the break. The idea of some of these influencers, if I may call them that, sort of becoming a cliche of themselves, which Cam also alluded to in terms of just sort of replicating something that then becomes that has become associated with them. Is that the worst thing, though? I mean, to keep giving them what they want?
So we spoke about Tenet not too long ago, and we can't say why, obviously, because a lot of people haven't seen it, but Nolan sort of repeats himself, and he has a concept that he keeps going back to. Most people know what that is. Tarantino has the same thing with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I don't know if it's wrong. I think that after a while, it might backfire, I feel. And that's the same thing. I hate to bring up Michael Bay again and again, but it's what happened to him. He did make good action films in the late 90s. It's just that he kept doing the same thing and getting bigger and bigger, building on the same concept of action filmmaking, that he became a parody of himself. And I think that's a very real possibility with some filmmakers who can't get out of their own persona, their own gimmick.
Well, yeah, Kurosawa did amazing things with samurais over like a 50-year period.
Yes. I mean, I think at least half of his filmography are samurai films, but none of them feel like retreats.
No. That's a good point. He also had, but in the middle of his career, he'd have real downtime where he was unable to raise money. He couldn't make movies at all. Mm-hmm. So I think you have to look at their personal lives as well. So there's the young Kurosawa making Throne of Blood, which is just, it's 100 BPM. And then he comes back as an older man making Ran, and he slowed it down to like 60 BPM. But it's got samurai, but it's dazzling. What a man can do over an entire lifetime.
So I think this is interesting because I don't mind a Tarantino repeating himself, because I feel like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is peak Tarantino. I really don't mind at all. However, someone like Tim Burton has fallen into the trap of becoming almost a caricature of himself. There are all these beats that he almost seems to think he needs to hit, and it starts feeling very formulaic. So I do think that that is an issue when you sort of become a legend in your own time in some ways.
Is that because of the storytelling or because of the concept? because Wes Anderson has the same concept every single time, the same kinds of shots, the same kinds of color schemes, not same color schemes, but the same use of color. You know, what he does in the same way he writes characters and how they speak to each other and that kind of awkward quirkiness. Is that a problem with story, or a problem with the way he tells the story? I think that's why Wes Anderson works, and that's why Tim Burton doesn't, because he just keeps saying the same things over and over again with the same style. Or am I wrong?
I think you've got something there. It's style standing in for story, I think.
Yeah, and also Wes Anderson owns the copyright on that that world. He can't come along and do...
Yeah, it's the Wes Anderson world. Yeah. Like, we all know what that
is. He can't do, like, I'm going to do Wes Anderson, but better. with tracking shots and jets.
I would watch
and
that
Transformers,
movie, though.
Really.
I think I would.
It might be interesting. Wes Anderson's Transformers.
Transformers, Wes Anderson's crossover is the thing I want to watch.
We're talking about the same guy again. He's like, he's pretty much like hijacked this show.
Who knew? Who knew?
Yeah.
But we do have, so we have a couple of people who have WhatsApped in. Someone said Oliver Stone, an interesting name, because not a name I often think of as influential, even though I do think of him as distinctive.
I think his JFK was enormously influential, not necessarily perhaps on filmmakers, but on the audience. The whole QAnon, the whole kind of like conspiracy theory thing, Oliver Stone really set the ball rolling on that. He owns it now.
We also had someone else who name-checked Quentin Tarantino again and said he has the ability to align soundtrack to action scenes in movies. I'll quote Kill Bill 1 and 2, best fight scene using samurai swords between Lucy Liu and Uma Thurman, set to flamenco disco of Santa Esmeralda. And then there's also Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, Jackie Brown, Django Unchained, Inglourious, the word I can't say probably, all classics. Yeah, Tarantino is a name that I think we were talking about because we did want to kind of cap off the show with, I guess, who we think in today's world, who are making films now, who years from now film students will be studying and sort of saying, I aspire to be a so-and-so. Tarantino, I think, has safely earned that spot, no?
Yeah, and also going back to the clip we just played, that was Blade Runner 2049. So yes. Denis Villeneuve, and it's interesting because I just thought about Ridley Scott, and he himself has become sort of, it's wrong to say that he's become a parody of himself.
15 years ago, Ridley Scott would have been the Denis Villeneuve clip we picked, I think.
Yes, for sure. But now it's like every time you go back to Ridley Scott, it's about androids and aliens and future people. He can't let go of that Prometheus concept. It's like, you know, where did man come from? And I want to tell this story. But Denis Villeneuve himself with Blade Runner, which is a really interesting case because he followed Ridley Scott's footsteps. The sort of practical effects, the building large set pieces, the colors, the themes. But he's also paving the way in his own method. Like he's making a name for himself in Hollywood. So I think he's a very interesting study to see what he's going to do uniquely, but also how he's following the guys from the 80s and 90s who made movies at that time.
I'd agree. And I think that Villeneuve has yet to make his Blade Runner, as it were. he has a real masterpiece in him. And I'd like to see.
You don't think Arrival is it? Arrival is
really great, really great. But I think he can take it up a notch. I don't know what his Dune's going to be like. I don't know.
Oh yeah, I'm sort of on the fence with the trailer, but yeah, I'm very excited to see what he does with it.
But I think with Tarantino, I think that he's made a mark. He's a very important character. I think that he is deservedly rated, although probably overrated. You mentioned Kill Bill 1, 2, 3, 4. What a load of trash that was. Absolute
the contrarian
garbage.
Of the show, as always.
Oh, come on, people. But having said that, Django Unchained, I think there are moments in that where he looked at, say, slavery in a way that was kind of like it's a fun journey for the audience. But at the same time, the way that he actually looked at the characters in slavery was terrifying and brilliantly achieved. He taking risks that I don't think any other filmmaker would have made.
So Tarantino himself is, of course, someone who is, I mean, he makes pastiche films. Yeah. He draws from so many filmmakers that have come before. And so I'm not sure what exactly one would be influenced by, because Tarantino himself is making sort of homage to cinema in many, many ways over and over again.
It's like with the what was the most recent one? Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Once Upon a Time, yeah.
If you are not familiar with Hollywood folklore, if you don't know about the Charlie Manson murders, that movie is meaningless.
No, I completely agree. That one I completely agree. Because I feel that film is like severely overrated. It looks good. I don't think it's a good film because of the things that you just mentioned, like Quentin Tarantino sort of doing the same things over and over. It's a bloated Tarantino film, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Bloated's a good word.
So there's a tweet from Sheng An who lists a few names which I think might be useful to this conversation. So in terms of world building and having a singular vision, it has to be Chris Nolan, Wes Anderson, Peter Jackson, a name that has not come up, Tim Burton and Quentin Tarantino. Peter Jackson, certainly just Lord of the Rings alone is going to influence, a couple of generations of how to make epic fantasy.
Especially with computer graphics. I would say that on that list, he is the Ringo Starr on that list. Mm. And I'm a big fan of Ringo Starr. in terms of computer graphics, what he did visually with graphics was spectacular and has not been achieved again. But what he did at King Kong shows his limitations as a filmmaker.
So he's a technology builder. You say that like more of a you know, he figured out the tech to do certain things and like the motion capture and stuff.
Yeah, but it's a painting. They're paintings. Painterly quality. One of the few occasions where you're watching it, it's like, I don't know, this is computer graphics. I don't care. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think I like to think of Peter Jackson as someone who. He's very good at telling. He's very good at having a vision for a story. I don't know whether he is great at sort of. He gets. I think he falls in love with that vision, and doesn't know when it could be toned down and when it needs to be allowed to fly.
And cut by half an hour.
That too. Yes.
just half an hour.
King Kong, 1 hour. You could have cut 1 hour.
Yeah,
no,
for sure.
No
for
problem.
Sure.
So we have Dee Dee, who WhatsApped in to say, I'd like to put forward Johnny Toe and his Gun Ballet, one of the few directors who are able to pull off both commercial and esoteric films, and Tarantino has cited him as an influence. Dashran actually WhatsApped in Cam to say, Blade Runner is Denis Villeneuve. Arrival is Denis Villeneuve's Villeneuve's Blade Runner. It's a masterpiece.
Maybe. I'd like to. It's a movie I'd like to watch again. I think it's a very good film. I enjoyed it.
It's a very good film.
So I, as we kind of come to the end of the show, as the only female, the only woman in the show today, it's not escaped my attention that this list that we've been talking about is very, very predominantly male, very, very predominantly white, except for maybe Kurosawa, who, I mean, let's face it, is every white filmmaker's influence. And I was wondering whether why is it that even now in 2020, when we have these conversations, that we still can't name beyond, say, a Sofia Coppola, people who are more diverse, I suppose.
I'm going to say it's going to be changing. It's really going to be changing and very fast. Filmmakers have been male. You got to be young, actually, to make a film. You know, it takes a lot of energy. And so they're male. And so they're filled with guy energies and guy thoughts and stuff. And they think like that and they're surrounded by more men. It's like, yeah, it's great. More Transformers. And but it has been noted that, as you say, you know, the lists are missing, and that, you know, the audience is crying out for more fair. So we're going to find a whole new set of filmmakers who may not all be women, actually be men as well, but who can really crack the code on making movies that you know, go across genders.
Honestly, I think we could explore this on like a whole supercut by itself.
And we did do the female director show. Yeah. And one of the things that we talked about was the fact that when you don't see enough of them, you don't think you belong there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also the studio system, right? We spoke about that as well. It's like, you know, whose movies are you going to greenlight? And all the filmmakers that we spoke about, the big names, have essentially been greenlit by major studios who allowed them to take a chance. Like, who would allow Nolan to make his movies? Honestly, like, if you came with a concept like that and said, I want to release this in summer to make like $1 billion, no one would greenlight him. But it's the studio system that sort of favors that thing, and they gave him the chance to do it. I think, like Cam said, if, you know, moving forward, a lot of the female filmmakers get chances like that, especially with streaming services, then they might enter the fold and start paving out and start creating their own influences for the future. Hopefully, fingers crossed.
So just to cap the show off, I thought we could each talk about one filmmaker who doesn't fit into this white male list of influential, and see who we came up with.
I'd say Sally Potter.
Ah, interesting.
One movie in particular, Orlando, which was a movie version of a Virginia Woolf novel. I went to that thinking, oh God, it's going to be so boring. It's like going to be chick stuff. I don't know what it is. And I was absolutely mesmerized. It had a tone and a pace that was ethereal, and I'd just never seen on celluloid before. And I don't know if I've really seen it since. And it's a moment that I'll cherish, and I almost dare not go watch that movie again in case I don't see that again.
Arvin?
So still male, but I wanted to throw Spike Lee's name into the mix because we haven't spoken about Spike Lee. And I think that he is so important for the way he told stories for the African-American community and like the Black community, just to prove to Hollywood that they don't always have to be gangsters. They don't always have to fit like a certain kind of role. He told ordinary stories about like neighborhoods and places with people doing different things. And I think Spike Lee mainstreamed that. After a long time trying, he sort of pushed that concept forward and got Hollywood to accept that it is okay, that you can tell these stories and you can make money telling these stories. So Spike Lee would be my pick.
So Zikri reminded us that James Wan is not white, point well made. And Dashrun did mention Maniratnam just now, yes. Who again, yeah. So
and can I just, before you round us off there, Sharma, also South Korean cinema.
Yes.
Just about anything.
I thought you were going to mention them, and I was shocked
that
you didn't.
I know, and I got to shoehorn that in. So anything from South Korea.
And I was just going to say, it's actually the same director that I ended the female director show with, Greta Gerwig.
Yes.
I love her films, and I think the reason she's going to be a huge influence on filmmaking is because she has created a visual language for what it means to tell stories of women in a way that's not derived from previous male points of view. And I think that's very important because people do need to be influenced. This whole show has talked about how everyone is influenced by someone that came before them. And if we want to see more female filmmakers, we need female filmmakers who show them how that can be done.
Yeah, to crack the code also, making riveting entertainment. Lady Bird, what's the plot? I don't know. But it's beautiful.
Yeah. You can't stop watching.
Well, thank you, everyone, for all of these wonderful suggestions. I really feel like I need to catch up on some of my movie making. But keep those thoughts coming. You can continue to tweet us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. And for updates related to our show, thoughts and things in pop culture, we are at BFM Popcorn on Instagram and Twitter. So that's it from us today. You've been listening to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.